The Labour Committee of the Greater Toronto Workers' Assembly has organized a conference called Building the Working Class Movement, where activists can come together to talk about the attacks on the working class in every dimension of our lives, reframe the public discussion, and hope to form a united activist network of workers from all sectors: unions, precarious workers, new immigrants, and non-unionized workers, to mobilize a new kind of working class movement. In this conference, their keynote speaker was Brenda Stokely. Brenda Stokely is a human rights activist dedicated to ending all forms of national oppression, racism, sexism, and exploitation of workers. She co-founded and built several key organizations, including the 2004 Million Worker March, New York Labor Against the War, and many others. Here is Brenda Stokely.
We all should be grateful that we have people like Faith and the sisters who sung this morning, because when you're battered every day, when you're challenged every day, every quarter of your life, you need the inspiration and the soul rebuilding and repairing. And that's what our culture and our movement provides to us. There isn't a movement, there isn't a culture, there isn't a nationality that does not have that tradition. And the oppressed nationalities in particular cling onto that tradition because it's how we made it through all of the treacherous things that we had to go through and survive. Sitting here among us are those who are the survivors, both those who are from oppressed nationalities, as well as those of us who have been on the battlefield working in unions, trying to organize in the best traditions of the unions and the best traditions of workers. So what's most important is what you're doing today and what you did last night to try to pull together and gather together those warriors and those fighters that must lead the repairing and the rebuilding of our movements wherever we are. So I am grateful to be amongst you because I am always grateful to be amongst warriors. I'm always grateful to be among people who do not get pessimistic, but are always trying to be problem solvers no matter what they face every day. We don't have the luxury, the time, nor can we claim to be revolutionaries or warriors if we're sitting down in the midst of our tears. The old adage was, don't mourn, organize. And that was when somebody was being hung because they fought for the 8-hour day. The slaves, people who were enslaved, who marched, walked, secreted, and fought and waged slave rebellions for freedom, those are the people on whose shoulders we stand. We cannot betray them by not building the kind of movement to continue to struggle till we get to the final place that we need to be, and that's a society that honors, respects, nourishes, and involves people in decision making and is not run by the imperialists. We have that challenge, and it's not an unrealistic challenge. It's a challenge that we must take on. We don't have a choice at all but to take that challenge. And the importance of us coming together, me coming across the border here from the belly of the beast, the one who's trying to steal jobs, not me, from you all, is to also say that there are warriors in every country, in every region, and every community. And to build a movement, one of the key things that I've learned over the years is that we don't need somebody to propel into somebody's community or somebody's workplace to organize for them and tell them how to organize. What we need is to honor and respect those indigenous organizers in those communities, among those nationalities, and in those workplaces. Because every movement produces its warriors. And what we need to do is to gather those warriors whenever and as often as we can to exchange our experiences and to highlight our victories and to talk about our defeats in the framework of how do we not let that happen again. And how do we organize better? And how do we defeat the imperialists better? And how do we build a bigger and bigger and bigger, stronger movement? So today is very important. And I was listening last night, and one of the themes that seemed to keep on manifesting itself, and unlike me, I'm not that polite. The sisters and brothers who spoke last night did not really hammer home what that big elephant is that's sitting in the room. They spoke about it, they said it, and they all said it. One of the reasons why I feel that we're in the place where we are in terms of not having the kind of movement is because there have been decades after decades of betrayal of ourselves. And one of those betrayals was to be convinced that it is okay for us to let any sector of the working class be denigrated. That we could allow any sector of the working class to have less than us. That we can let any sector of the working class be murdered, be butchered, be displaced, be given slave wages or no wages at all, to be harmed at the workplace, to be shuffled and displaced from their homes, that it's okay as long as it ain't happening to me. That it's okay because I still got my good union job, I still got my benefits, I still got my home, I still got my one or two cars, my children are still going to college. So it's them over there. It must be their problem. They are the others. And I don't have to unite with them. I don't even have to contend with them. I don't have to see them. And I definitely don't have to organize with them. That's what they were saying. And we don't want you to organize with us from a charitable point of view. We want you to organize with us as side-by-side revolutionaries, warriors, sisters and brothers in the movement. Not as second-class citizens, people that you feel sorry for. Not as people that you think you are smarter than, that you are more abreast of what needs to be done, and you need to come and tell us what to be done. No, we want you to stand side by side, arm by arm, and understand that by doing that, we are creating the greatest threat against the imperialists. That's what they were saying, but they didn't hit it home because they were being polite. White skin privilege needs to be defeated. You cannot be free in your white skin if we are enslaved in our brown, our yellow, our red skins. It ain't happening. And now it's coming to bite you in the ass because you took that stand, because you closed your eyes. And now, when we used to always say in the black community, when white folks sneeze, we get pneumonia. Well, you're doing a lot more than sneezing. You're beginning to experience the kind of conditions that we've been living under for a long time. Where we can be cast out of a job without even thinking about it. Where we can lose our homes without even thinking about it. Where our kids won't go to school because they can't afford it and schools are closing. That you're going to have to give up that car. And in the United States, I know it's a little bit different here, people have to give up their American dream, and that's their homes. And that you are being villainized. It was okay to let people of color be villainized. But now you're being villainized. You're being criminalized. And this is not the first time it's happened in the history of the movement. So the question is that one of the main things that we have to do is not give verbiage, not have it just in slogans and newspapers and on our placards, that we're really building an anti-racist, anti-sexist, working class movement led by working people. It must be in our practice. Every single day, it must be in our practice in terms of how we respect those people that are lowest and deepest in terms of the working class, the ones who get the lowest wages, who work in the most dangerous jobs. They have to be leaders of their own struggle, and you listen to the people here, they're quite capable, if you had any illusions that they're not, to lead their own struggle. So what is the struggle for those who are not from oppressed nations? What should the struggle and the role be of those who are still fortunate enough to be in unionized jobs and still able to organize? It is to reach across your comfort zone. It is not, as the sisters and brothers said, you come with your story of pain and somebody says, well, how much money can I throw at it? That's what they said. They said they didn't want that. Not that they didn't want the money, but from comrades, they want something much more. Going back to the 60s, one of the distinguishing factors was that there was a revolutionary fever across the world. And then when revolutionaries came together, whatever language they spoke, wherever they lived, whatever they're confronting in their movement, they stood shoulder to shoulder with you because your struggle was their struggle. They didn't see it as separate. They didn't see it as being clients of the United States workers and coming here and begging with their hats in their hands. They saw themselves as matching side by side with the warriors that were in the United States. They understood, and that was a piece that we had to force home in the Montreal, that those of us who were there from the United States, from the belly of the beast, we weren't the beast. And if you have any illusions that there isn't an anti-imperialist movement in the United States, that is something you need to quickly get rid of, because there always has been a movement of that nature. And sometimes it's going down, and sometimes it's rising up. I'm of the view that now, across the world, that the rising up is bubbling up, and we have to take advantage of this moment and time. It is no error or no mistake or no magic that the Guadeloupe and Martinique sisters and brothers could go on general strike. And what were the two? They didn't just raise up economic issues. They raised up the issue of the cloak of colonialism and racism, as well as the issues of pay, as well as the issue of social justice and benefits and things to help them survive. How did they do that? It was led by organized labor. But it was throughout the whole country, and they could even influence Martinique to join hands with them against the French, who were still their colonizers. How did they do that? Those are questions that we need to examine. We need to look at what's happening in Egypt. We need to look at what's happening in Tunisia. We need to look at what's happening in Palestine. We need to look at what's happening in our own countries and see and find all those embers and help them grow into a great flame that means that is the form of the movement. So we have to recognize, because it inspires you, if you listen to the bullshit that the imperialists tell you every day, you will be sitting in a well of tears. I never listen to them other than to think of how I can counter their asses and to think about what we need to do, and that's another piece of it. How do we, people were talking about taking things to the working class. What we need not to do is to take and describe their pain. They already know that. They don't need you to come and tell them how painful it is to be a part sector of the working class. What they need is for us to all come together like you're doing this weekend and collaborating and using our best practices. What has worked when you were confronted with this? Can we apply it here? What is our history of resistance? That's what the class has been blotted out, because they don't want you to know that you have resisted. They don't want you to know that you have been victorious. They want you to take for granted that anything that you have wrenched from this wretched beast, you wrenched from their hands because you were organized and courageous and brave, and you fought for it and you got it. So we tell people, you didn't get that unemployment check because some benevolent imperialist said, oh, let me see, there's all these people that are unemployed in the 30s, maybe we could give them unemployment. No, their asses were on the line. They knew that if the movement kept building the way it was all across the country, it was gonna take the shit over, take the country over, take the government over, and build a worker society. And they said, it is cheaper to make a concession and give them unemployment, give them Social Security. But we won that. That was a victory. And all of the things that you have here in this country and in Ontario, you won those things. But what happens is that there is amnesia, purposeful amnesia on the part of the class, because we have misleaders leading the class. We have people who have accepted the stale crumbs not from the imperialist table, but from the floor, and accepted them in exchange from blotting out any memory, any class memory of resistance. That is also there and accepting those crumbs to make sure that if there are any embers, that they squash them. By directing you into madness that takes you down the path to Never Never Land. We don't want to be the Never Never Land. We want to be in the land of the free, those who are brave, and those who can control their own destiny. We want to be in a working class society. But they do everything to divide the virtue. Even from the standpoint, one of the lessons that I have learned from the civil rights movement in the United States, in comparison to the working class, organized labor sector, they had nothing. They didn't have the money. They always had some form of organization, otherwise we wouldn't, some of us who have a darker skin wouldn't be standing here. They always had some form of organization, both military and otherwise. But they didn't have money. They were despised by the whole country. They didn't have any control over any media outlets. But what they did have and what they did understand is that the only way they won anything was militant disruption of the status quo. That's what the slave rebellions were. Well, you think I'm gonna still be your slave? I'm leaving, and I'm taking a bunch of folks with me. And if you stand in my way, the consequences are yours. I'm gonna organize the Underground Railroad. I'm gonna organize slave rebellions. And in the civil rights movement, what they were saying is that I'll close down your town. I will close down your bus system. I will close down your stores. I will close down your schools. So they didn't go and organize a rally when the oppressors weren't around. They didn't organize a rally at 5 o'clock when everybody has gone home or the building is empty. They didn't organize a rally on the weekend when ain't no workers outside, much less they're not there. They're off somewhere in one of their third or fourth homes. They organized things very consciously that was gonna disrupt it. We're not talking about madness. We're talking about some things that probably seem very simple and tame to us today, but people would have been murdered and were murdered. They were beaten, their jobs were taken from them, and their homes. If I went and walked up the steps during that time to the county seat to register to vote, the county office would close, just me by myself. But if I organized, like, and this is the other thing too in terms of our mythology, letting other people rewrite our history and take the heart of the revolutionary aspects of it out. Rosa Parks was no little old lady whose feet got tired. Rosa Parks was a warrior. That was an organized plan. And some of us can't stand out in the street for 30 seconds, much less be out for over a year in a bus boycott. So there's something wrong here in terms of us not understanding those things. So when they had the bus boycott, it wasn't something that was unnoticed. It wasn't something that the imperialists could pretend wasn't happening. It wasn't something that the Jim Crow regime couldn't act like it didn't disrupt what they were doing. So our challenge is to look at how do we challenge them? When we have actions, I think most of us have become event planners, not revolutionary organizers, not activists. We go from one event to the other. Our meetings are to look at the event that we had and plan the next event or the next meeting. And then the events that we have, we go to DC, for example, the United States, when ain't nobody there. Nobody's there, but here we are. We have young people saying, well, I'm gonna have an action. What is that action gonna be? Oh, I'm gonna sit down here on this street. And I said, but there's no traffic and there ain't no people here. So the police said, sure, how long do you wanna be there? I mean, you can stay there forever because you ain't doing nothing. You ain't disrupting nothing and ain't nobody gonna even see you or cover it. So I mean, these are things that what we do is we take direct action. We take civil disobedience, but we take the skeleton of it. We take the heart out, we don't lose the objective of those actions and those methods of organizing. We just forget it. We don't think we need it, or we're not courageous enough to do it. We can answer the question, which one category do we fall in? So we need to look at those practices, even the strikes that we have. People come, and I'm not going to talk about you all up here because I don't know. This is my first time to Toronto. But I know in the United States, people come in, workers, well, where's the pad where I can sign in? Am I going to still get paid for the day? No, you ain't going to get paid for being on strike. And no, we don't need you to sign in nothing. We need you to organize the workers that weren't here. You need to show up again, but you need to organize. So we've taken, withhold your labor is very significant. We ask why we can't get to a general strike, because we can't even do a mini strike. So until we can do the mini strikes the way they're supposed to be done, so that the objective aim is the imperialists must hurt and must bleed. The imperialists must know that you are a force to be reckoned with. How would they know that when you're playing with yourself and you ain't doing nothing? And nobody even knows that you're over there doing that. So we have the capability. We also have the lessons from our history. We have some strong organizations. We have many organizations that could be strengthened. We have the interest to come together and work together. We also have the interest to defeat that elephant, white skin privilege. We have the interest to defeat sexism. Because all those things is part of the weaponry, not for us, is the weaponry for the imperialists. How many ways can I split up the workplace? I worked in a workplace where we had so many different nationalities. And of course, we had the different genders. We won't say what kind of jobs and pay the women got versus the men, because you all know that story. And management played that like a fiddle. They play the division between the blacks and the Russians and the Latinos, those who had degrees versus those who didn't have degrees, those who were in the older title versus the ones that are in the new titles, and those that were easily always volunteering to be bribed. So we had to find out a way to cut through that. And one of the things was to constantly talk about the commonality of the impact of the work of the bosses on all of us. I don't care what language you speak, and I don't care what color your skin is, but when they take our wages away from us and lower them, when they take our benefits away, and when they decide to lay off people, they're gonna come after you just like they're gonna come after me. And if you, one of the things was the two-tier system, which I don't know if you have it up here, but I know that that is a common practice and in the arsenal of the imperialists and was very much used in the United States. And courageously, people try to say, don't buy into that. But you heard the selfish, backward ideas of some of those in our working class movement who said, why should I care whether or not this person over here gets less benefits than I do? Why do I care if that person doesn't get any severance pay or very little? Why do I care if that person has to pay for health benefits and I don't? And that goes back to, because quiet as it's kept in the United States, the leadership of the organized labor is still mainly white men, of mostly all of our internationals, with very, very few exceptions. Although we have a lot of people of color, more people of color, I should say, taking on local leadership. But they didn't raise that fight. They actually encouraged that people turn their back on the other workers. So we all know what happens. I'm gonna come in, she has a host, a big bag full of benefits, I don't get shit or half of what she has, and I'm paying the same dues. Am I in the same organization as she's in? Should I have any allegiance to that same organization? When you ask me to come to a union meeting, should I come? When you ask me to go on strike to fight for something, should I do that? No. No, I'm not going to do it, because you have allowed the bosses to divide us and make me a second-class citizen in my same union that I'm in with you. And that happened repeatedly. Now that is coming to bite them on the butt. Because now what happens, people say, well, I'm only concerned about me. I'm here, and they're not here. These are you talking about the new workers that might be coming. They're not even here. Why should I be kidding? I said, because you know what's going to happen? You're not going to be here, and the new workers will be here. Because we went to the table, we said we want one tier, the one we had before, the top tier. And the boss says, we're in agreement. We want one tier too, but we want the lowest tier. So what does that mean? What does that inform you? You at the highest tier? They're going to get rid of you, which is what they did, and keep all the people in the lower tier because they can enslave me. And the same thing with the immigrant workers. Oh, they're my enemy. I don't want to have anything to do with them. They're coming. But what happens in construction trades? What happens in the industries? What happens in the social service places? They will get rid of you all who had good benefits and good jobs, the sister was talking about in the public sector, for example, and replace you with the new slaves. That they have devastated their own economies in their own countries so that they have to come and seek, like immigrants have always done, to look for a way to survive. The biggest joke in the United States is, ain't nobody crossing nobody's border. People are coming back to their own land that you stole from them. So how dare you, Border Patrol? How dare you kill people from coming back to their own land? That's one piece of it, but the other piece is, how dare other workers organize to support that view? And what is the big elephant here that informs people that that's the side they should be on? Just like what was the elephant that informed people like the sister's father and others to go and say that this man should have been the mayor, Ford? He's great, just like in New York City. Oh, we need Bloomberg because he's a businessman and businessmen don't know how to do things right. Yeah, they certainly do. They know how to screw you royally, take all your shit, and kill you. So we certainly do need the Wall Street Bloomberg, who people should wonder. No one's asking him. With all the crisis in New York, not only did Bloomberg not lose any money, he made more money. Is that a question in anybody's head? But we are taught, and that's what we have to fight in other ways, any way we can, with popular literature, one-on-one discussions, all the things that we do that's right when we want to bring workers into a union or bring workers into a group, and then we stop doing it after they get there. We need literature that is popular and clear for workers and in different languages that explains to them and highlights all the questions that they have themselves and provides the information that workers who are working real hard don't have time to sit at the internet for 500 hours. And get that information. But some of us have the ability to do that. So those some of you, instead of trying to lead that movement, go to the computer, get the information, and help the workers produce the kind of literature that they can take themselves, not you, to their communities, to their workplaces, and discuss them with other workers. So we need popular literature that constantly, one, reinforces why the class has the mandate that it has. What the imperialists are doing in terms of not, they know what they're doing to them, but it's good for migrant workers, for example, to know what's happening to all migrant workers. How can we, and who is the villain? Who are the common villains in that case? All the people that are in the industries, who is the common villain? U.S. Steel bringing their ass up here to take your company over and then throw you out in the street? How many people in New York and in some of the old industrial areas even know about that? You'd be surprised at how ill-informed that workers are about what's happened to other workers by companies that are coming from the United States. People are talking about China. Oh, every time I go to a store, I look at the back and it says China. China stole our jobs. I didn't see a Chinese person come over here and take our garment industry. I didn't see a Chinese person just pack it up and then take it someplace. I saw the greedy imperialists take our shit over there because there were no regulations about them doing that. They could hide their monies and their profit, that their maximum profit, because they ain't never been interested in no minimum miserly pocket. Like the misleaders will take the old crumbs from the bread. They want the maximum top of the line profit. So they're gonna get it any way they can. So we need to really kind of do a lot of exposures. We don't, as we all know, we don't have control over the media, but we don't really need that control. Like people say, oh, we need the social networks and blah, 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 blah. what happened to the social network that was shut down in Egypt and those people are still out in the street? Explain, because we always find excuses why we are not doing what we need to do. Those are excuses. We've had 3 million person marches in the United States. The million man, the million woman was 2.1 million because somebody had a baby, and the million more movement. The Nation of Islam put out a call, and some sisters, two sisters, helped try to organize the million person march. But in no way in hell did they get those million people there from a centralized base. Those people, I believe, came because the old network that Harriet Tubman relied on and the other enslaved people relied on is alive and well. And when someone who you respect in your community, in your building, in your workplace, in your church, in your faith-based organization say, we need to show up, the question is, how do we get there? And we don't use excuses. That's how those million, you think that those marches were advertised by the bourgeois press? People didn't even know anything about using social networks. They didn't know about Twitter, or whatever that stuff is. I still don't know about it, not interested. They knew about each other. I know her, she's always fighting for us. She stands up when the boss threatens to kick her butt, she still stands strong. She said she found out about this march and maybe we should all think about going. Let's see what it's about. Let's see how we could get there. When you talk to the people as you walked around, that's how they all got there. The both of the Million Man March, the Million Women March, and also the Million More March. So we can drag out a million people. The only problem is that, with the exception of the first one, the Million Man, they were done on a day when nobody was around except for us. Although there was a lot of us. But the first one, the Million Man March, was actually done on a work day. So that meant that people took off work. And a lot of those people didn't have paid benefits that took off work, and that's why they came. They also brought their children with them. And some of them brought their spouses with them, and the women came on their own to support that. So we have the ability to do this. The question we need to ask ourselves is, why the hell are we not doing it, not doing it enough, and not doing it often enough? We can do it, we must do it, and we have the capacity to do it. We need to throw out all the things that don't work, all the illusions that we have about what workers can and cannot do. We spend more time, like at a meeting, instead of saying, oh, look at all the people that came to the meeting. Let's see how we can employ them. And when they leave there, they have some work to do. So when we come back, we are a step ahead. Instead, let's spend 5 hours talking about who didn't show up. And demoralizing the people who did show up. So we need, meetings must be meaningful, and I'm very task-oriented. I ain't coming and sitting in your meeting and leaving, listening to somebody with some theoretical bullshit telling me something that happened in the 1800s. I'm gonna come to the meeting because someone is analyzing, or we're analyzing together, what's going on, and we're gonna come up with a plan on how to tackle that. And we could debate that, but we're gonna leave with a plan. And I'm gonna leave with the task or several tasks, and so are you. And so when we come back, the question is, did you carry out those tasks? And what was the end result of you carrying out those tasks? So we need to really look at our style of work. We need to look at the lessons learned. We need to look at the things that people do that succeed. And we need to replicate those things and apply them, of course, to the particular conditions of the country, the community that you live in. We need to put out popular literature. That's what, when I was coming up in the movement, I still even have some of the raggedy pamphlets with the paper falling off and it's turning yellow. But these were pamphlets that were comprehensible, that enlightened me, and also reaffirmed what was happening to me, and that there were other people fighting too, and I wanted to be with those other people. So we need to think about what kinds of literature would best work. And then we also need to think about the fact that we have a destiny, we have a responsibility, and we have the courage to build the kind of society that we need. And we also have, coupled with that, of course, is the defeat of the imperialists. And we need to stop being afraid of using words that we weren't afraid to use in the 60s and the 70s. We were shouting them from all around. We'd be all around in the street, any place else, talking about those words. Who told us that we couldn't talk about those words anymore? Who was making up new words for us that don't really tell us who we are and what we must do and tell us who we have to align ourselves with? So we need to recapture our own traditions, our own glorious history. And when I say us, I mean all of us. I mean anyone from any country, speaks any language of any color and any gender, that we need to all be together, because that is what they hate the most. They're still trying to figure out how the hell did all those people get out on the street, and they say, oh, this is day number six. One commentator said, when do you think this is going to end? Now, if the misleaders were there, some of our trade, they would say, well, boss, we were only going to be out here till maybe Friday at 3 o'clock. Is that okay with you, boss? And then we're ending, and we're going to go home, and we probably won't do this again to upset you. The man asked, he said, who could tell? They're going to stay out there till they accomplish their aim. So what are our aims, or what is our aim that we're working on together? And are we willing to hang in there until it is won? I made 65 in December. And if I live as long as my mother and other people to 80, I'm going to still be out there, even if I have a crutch or a cane, I'm going to be out there fighting until we win this. But I hope it happens before I get to be 80.
That was Brenda Stokely, the keynote speaker for the conference held in Toronto on January 30th called Rebuilding the Working Class Movement. And you're listening to Radio Migrante on CHRY 105.5 FM.